keep going green. That was the slogan at his party's national convention in Dublin last night. But Eamon Ryan also took aim this weekend at his coalition partners, accusing them of making easy, false promises, which he said would not win over the electorate in the upcoming elections. The Green Party leader Eamon Ryan is with us now in studio. Good afternoon and welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Justin.
We'll talk about your convention in a moment, but can I start with the biggest story of this week, the Stardust inquest and the verdict of unlawful killing. The Taoiseach has said that he will issue a full state apology to the victims of the Stardust tragedy and their families. And I know that you have spoken to him about that. What will that apology be for?
I think it will be for, in my mind, the first will be for the incredible many decades delay in justice. But I think we have to be careful because the Taoiseach met with the families yesterday, and I think that was very good and proper. And they correctly said that they want to work with the Taoiseach, with the Department of Taoiseach, on that wording and getting it right. And that will be completed and delivered on Tuesday. And not to preempt that or not to predict that, I think I think it's been harrowing, clearly, for those families for over four decades. And I think, in my mind, that first, my view is the first apology is for that delay in justice is the thing that should be included.
Would you also like to see a Garda cold case team re-examine the Stardust fire tragedy with a view to possible prosecutions?
I don't want to rule anything out, but I don't want to, as I said, be prescriptive at this stage. I think first what the families...
Is that something you would welcome?
I wouldn't rule it out, but I think what the families themselves said yesterday is they wanted to focus first on that apology, on getting that right, and on having that dull debate on Tuesday. And any further or other considerations, I think, has to come secondary after that. That's what the families themselves said, and I think they're correct.
Who will make that decision?
I think that will be something that the government obviously would have to consider.
In relation to a possible cold case review, who would make that decision?
We would first and foremost have to listen to the advice of the Attorney General. He would be, you know, government's legal advisor. But that's something, as I said, that isn't the immediate focus. The case has, or the conclusion of the legal process last week was hugely significant. We don't just immediately move on to the next stage. I think it's important just to consider the outcome of what was decided this week and issue that apology and get that right.
And given that that apology is going to come on Tuesday and it will be an apology for state failings as it is a state apology, will there be a redress scheme for the people who were affected by those failings?
Again, I heard the lawyer representing the families yesterday and asked that same question. He said that wasn't that what they want to consider on Tuesday or to be considered. They wanted not for that to be the first issue on the agenda, but to actually get this apology right. Because I think that sense of justice, the injustice of their story, the injustice of the of what's been said, the injustice around the narrative on this, to a certain extent, is the reason, one of the reasons why that apology is needed. And what the family's lawyer themselves said is that needs to come first before any other considerations.
Yesterday, you hit out at the big spending promises that were made by your partners in government, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, in recent weeks at their own party conferences. You described those as false promises and said voters wouldn't be won over by them. Which promises do you think were false?
Well, firstly, I that wasn't the central message we were making yesterday. It was the front page in the Irish Independent, and they were reporting on a conversation, a private conversation I'd had with my colleagues back at the start of last week. And there I did say that we have to be careful here, that firstly, the budget will be in October. And if we spend the next 6 months just kind of trying to think what's in that, we would miss out on all the other work that we need to do. But also, I do believe we have to be careful in terms of promising tax cuts and spending increases. Historically, that's always got us into trouble. And also, I believe the electorate are kind of, they don't actually, I think, have real credibility. I think we won't know the economic situation until closer to the budget, and we should wait that. One thing I said, and using this opportunity to say that we do know about the budget, it will be progressive. We have agreement, Pascal Donoghue, Michael McGrath, all three parties agree that it will be progressive. It will protect those on lowest incomes. We have done that in each of the four budgets under this government. We've made sure before we signed off on any budget that we were able to show through independent research analysis from the Economic and Research Institute that it did protect the poorest.
But
and that one of the reasons I mentioned that is that too also brings constraints in terms of what you can promise in every other area.
But you did speak this weekend about your partners in government making false promises. I mean, when Fianna Fáil says that it will be increasing child benefit by 10 euro or pensions by 12 euro or cutting taxes or giving more energy credits this winter, are those false promises?
No, they're fully entitled to, obviously fully entitled to set out what they see as some of the priorities they want to deliver within government. What I was saying, and again, it was more in the privacy, it wasn't necessarily a public discussion, but just was, I think in terms of the management of the budget process, is that if we spend the entire next 6 months debating what might be in it, we won't actually focus on what we need to do now. The budget process does take time. It actually does work out probably over a certain process, but that means that starts with our liaising with our European colleagues and what our economic situation is. A summer economic statement, which goes into more detail of what our spending arrangements will be. And then only then, at the very end in September, starting to consider some of the final measures. And even with the budget, you only really decide in the last week on some of those tax and other spending measures. And you can only do it when you see the whole document. And therefore, the only point I was making is to kind of ramp that up through the 6 month period in advance of that doesn't make sense.
You said last night in your speech that Ireland is going green and everyone has a role to play. One of the things the government is planning to do is to seek an extension of the derogation from the EU Nitrates Directive. And that's designed, as you know, to clean up our rivers and our lakes by limiting the use of fertiliser on farmland. If Ireland does seek that derogation extension, it will be the only country in the EU to do so. Denmark this week dropped its plans to seek an extension to a derogation. Should Ireland rethink this one?
Ireland will only be able to get a derogation if our water quality improves. That is, and that's clear from the European Union, whether we sought or not one, I don't believe we would be successful in getting one unless we can show real progress in terms of improving water quality. And I think we can do that. In the last 2 years, our use of nitrogen fertilisers, one of the causes of the problems we have in terms of water pollution, has dropped by 30%. Now, that's helped lower costs for farmers. It helps us live up to the Origin Green brand that we're trading under. And I think and believe and certain that we can go further in that. You cannot give up on good water quality. It's a first fundamental condition.
OK, but then how can a Green Party in government, which says it's fighting for nature, for a cleaner environment, for rivers and lakes, stand by then and allow an application to proceed for a derogation extension on nitrates?
Because at the same time, what we will be doing is funding measures that will help farmers switch. That will help farmers, for example, switch towards mixed ward grassland systems, which also reduces fertiliser use by about something 70-80%, and also improves the output. It actually makes for better farming, makes for more resilient farming. The sort of conditions we've seen in the last 10 months when our fields are sodden, when you have a mixed ward grass system, you have a deep-rooted system, it actually stands up better against both drought and heavy rain conditions. So it's actually better farming. Similarly, we will in coming weeks and months introduce a new biomethane strategy, which allows farming to diversify away and get new incomes, particularly from the energy area, which again will also help us, in my mind, if we get it right and design it around water quality, which is the first thing we need to get right in that, then we can make real progress and actually advance Irish farming. And it is happening. I've been visiting some of the cooperatives recently, Tirlon, Lakelands and others. And they're starting to provide because they know that unless we are green in fact and not just in a marketing plan, they will not have a future in an export market. What they're starting to provide is options for farmers where you take environmental measures and pay a premium for that to the farmer, because they know that they need to be able to show that we are being demonstrably clean and green in what we do. So it's those sort of range of measures, I think, are the key practical changes on the ground that can actually turn around the whole issue of water quality in our country.
And speaking of payments to farmers, the Minister for Agriculture has said that there will be no scheme, no payments to incentivise farmers to exit dairy production. Do you agree with that position?
Well, firstly, that proposal came from the farming industry, the farming community, the farming organisation. organisations themselves, and it was up to Minister McConnell to decide whether, you know, to advance it or not. What there are is other mechanisms that we can fund farmers that I think can help. Firstly, within the climate, the infrastructure, climate and nature fund, which we're putting money aside for, some 3.15 billion of that is for climate and nature. And in that, I believe we can provide income measures, support measures to farmers to deliver some of the nature-based solutions we need.
So do you think then that there needs to be a different type of scheme devised to incentivise farmers to give up dairy production?
Not, I think, to incentivise farmers to promote agroforestry so that you keep farming and you stitch forestry within the farm. And we've again provided, Pippa Hapkett has organised it, 1.3 billion in a new forestry programme that does exactly that. So it's not stopping farming. I mean, to be honest, Justin, I think that one of the biggest problem we have is getting young people into farming. Like, the real issue is, how do we create a variety and diversity and stability and security of incomes so that you can, young people can go into farming? And to fund that, in my mind, is the first thing we should be doing, because we're going to need a whole new generation of farmers. The skills they have, existing and new, to manage land and to improve water quality and pay for that, that's where I think we should emphasise.
I want to ask you about your role as Minister for Transport. Are cheaper public transport fees going to be retained?
Again, I have to be careful here, because I don't want to be kind of predicting the budget in advance, so you have to be difficult. So we will have to wait to the budget.
Let me ask you a question in a different way. Is that going to be a priority for you when you go into budget negotiations?
Yes, clearly.
That you want to retain?
Clearly it would. But actually, the other priority, and in that, the really important one, is that we continue to expand public transport. And that is happening. It's dramatic what's happening. Firstly, in the Connecting Ireland new bus services, every week in the last 2 years, we've been introducing a new or enhanced bus service. And it's been in rural Ireland, in areas that haven't seen buses in years, decades. And it's working. Okay. People are flocking to it. And I could pick another dozen examples of investments we're making. The question I think we have, not so much maybe for the next budget, because we know it'll be follow our programme for government, but for the next government and to the other parties, will they agree to continue the policy we've set, that 10% of the capital budget in transport goes towards active travel, and the ratio of the remainder goes 2-1 in favour of public transport versus roads? Because I think the real gap, and this is not anti-car, it's not anti-motorist, but the absence or the lack of investment in public transport for decades has actually created a car-dependent system that doesn't work for anyone, because if it becomes gridlocked, then everyone gets stuck in traffic. Okay. Well, and I think the question I'd be asking in the manifestos, as well as in any budget discussions, is, are we agreed to keep going with the public transport investment? Because it's all ready to go. We have bus connects in Cork, ready to go.
We have bus connects
in Dublin, ready to go. And I could go around every city and county with similar list of projects that we are ready to invest in public transport that will transform this country for the better.
We did hear, though, this week that 80% of transport workers say they have been abused at work. In some cases, that abuse has been physical. Nearly 20% say they witnessed drug use on buses and trains on a daily basis. Why is the government so resistant to transport police?
Well, first, I met a lot of those workers. There was a very good meeting I had 2 weeks ago with SIP2 and a lot of the drivers and representatives of different workforces within our public transport system. And they have an absolutely valid point and an issue in terms of not tolerating harassment, but abuse of any form, both for them and for their passengers. The key question is, OK, what's the best way of addressing that? And some argue, including SIP2, that we should have a separate transport police. In seeking advice from that, from the Garda Síochána and the Department of Justice and our own department, they argue, no, that they don't believe that would necessarily lead
but
to a better...
what we have isn't working.
So what we need to do? Well, firstly, we put in a new control centre down in Houston Station, and that controls our whole rail system, but also it has in Garda Síochána located directly in offices right beside our public transport companies, so there's an instantaneous response. That's just opened, major investment, major new transport hub centre. But secondly, where we've had particular difficulties, and the most scary thing would be if you're on a route, let's say there's something thrown at the bus or there's real antisocial or worse behaviour. In instances where we've had to withdraw bus services, and there has been in recent years, what has worked to turn turn that round. It was actually community policing. It was actually the communities themselves saying, we refuse to accept that some people in our community are leading to the withdrawal of public transport
services.
Why, when
other countries have transport police that is an effective deterrent to crime and antisocial behaviour on public transport, why do we think in this country that it's not the solution?
Well, every country has different circumstances, and the An Gard Síochána have real powers and real capability and do respond and are engaged. And if there's any location or any service which is particularly suffering from abuse or from this threatening or from violent or any other disorder behaviour, clearly we have to deploy the resources there. The question is whether a separate police would do it or whether An Garda Síochána do it is an operational matter. We do have to take into account the views of the Department of Justice and the Garda Síochána. Right. And I do that.
I want to ask you about what happened to Roderick O'Gorman's house this week, or at Roderick O'Gorman's house. Masked men in balaclavas protested outside. The walls and railings of his house were covered in posters. It was widely condemned by politicians from all sides. Would you like to see the Gardaí taking a stronger, tougher approach to this type of intimidation?
Well, can I say firstly, this is not new. And it's not just outside someone's home. The online abuse that politicians are subject to, people don't quite understand, I think, or maybe see in their daily life who would be following what that. But actually, there's been a pattern, and it's going back a number of years now, of absolute organised, systemic abusive attacks on politicians, particularly online, but also people congregating outside their houses. It was a serious escalation last Thursday because in this instance, draped horrific banners on his own home. But also there were men there, masked men and men in balaclavas, which is a sinister, deeply troubling and worrying development. The question of how you police that. This organised campaign online, and it's ever happening. You'd often, as a politician, or I'd have someone who might come up to me and they'd have a phone thrust in your face and they start accusing you and start looking for you. And what they're looking for you to do is to retaliate back. So they get an online video clip, which they can put up and say, oh, look at this. And I won't even repeat the language or the nastiness. So the policing of it, we have to absolutely not tolerate, particularly if where it's looking, people are looking to escalate it. But how you best do that is something that you do need. You don't rush in just, or we have to be careful.
Okay, but do you think then that the Garda approach last Thursday was the correct one?
Well, Roderick believes that. He was asked that question, and he is best informed and best placed. I've seen it myself. We've had people outside our house. And listen, you do not want to wake up in the morning or look out your window and see with your children there that there's people at your front door, at your front gate. And always in my experience of that, the Garda Síochána, we've managed that in a way where we didn't want to escalate it. We didn't want them to get a victory where they can say, oh, look, police brutality or police are, who do they think they are? Which is what they're constantly trying to depict the political system as this other, as this kind of not connected to the people. First fundamental thing we need to get agreed here is these people do not represent Irish society. They are a tiny number. They often move from other areas into areas on an organised basis. They wrap themselves around the Irish flag. They have nothing to do. They do nothing, bring nothing but disservice to the Irish flag in my mind, because that's not our republic. That's not our what the vast majority of people Irish want to see. The first thing we need to do is make sure no one votes for any candidate in the local elections who are connected or support are encouraging for that sort of divisive politics. It's the last thing we need.
Some of those protests and some of those candidates' campaigns are centred around the issue of migration. Does the EU Migration Pact, which the government is signing up to, does it need more Doyle scrutiny before it's voted on? Just 3 hours at the Justice Committee and a Doyle debate. Michael McDougall was saying that it needs a lot more scrutiny than that.
Well, Michael has to be slightly careful, I'd have to say, because he is... there are a number of instances recently where a lot of the people I've just talked about see Michael as their great hero. And I think we have to be careful here that we're not kind of whipping up further distrust in the democratic
system. I think, to be
systems.
Fair to him, he has disassociated himself with some of those people.
I'm very glad, but they do.
But to his core point, does the legislation need more scrutiny?
And if that is the case, I would be fully supportive of us making sure we do provide time for that scrutiny. I don't disagree with the fundamental point, but I just have a slight concern that some of the heightened language and and very extensive fears that he is speaking of, and he's valid and he's fully entitled as a senator to raise them. I get on very well with Michael O'Doherty. I very much respect him. But I do have a slight concern that he has to be careful, or others, that we don't depict this country as trying to rush through, when this, as I understand, has been considered for some 8 years within the European Union system.
But there will have to be a Dáil vote on this. Is 3 hours at a committee enough?
If that requires further, that's a matter for the committee to consider, and I would be fully supportive of them if they can and should take more time to do it. But that's for the matter for the committee to consider.
All right. You said in your speech last night that a decision on funding for public sector media would be made before the summer. If Catherine Martin sticks to her view that funding should be direct exchequer funding rather than the licence fee funding public service broadcasting, are you going to support her in that decision?
Yes, but I think we do have to make a decision, and there will be a variety of options. I want an outcome where, I said it in my speech yesterday, this will be a hugely important legacy for Catherine, that we have solved this issue which has been avoided for decades, and for the government. And what, whichever that option is, and there will be a variety of ones suggested, we do have to make a decision. We have to come to a conclusion by this summer break.
And what's your favoured model?
To be honest, I've looked at this in such depth for so many years. I'm open to all models as long as it does actually provide a safe, secure funding model. And I tell you why, because this goes back to the core issue we were just talking about. If we're to protect our democracy, and in a world where a lot of those people, the reason that people are obsessed with the mobile phone issue on this and the online issue and the online abuse on this, because that increasingly is defining a lot of what people think in our society. You need the antidote to that, the way to respond to some of the fears and some of the mistruths that are put abroad, is to have really good quality journalism right across this country in local and national media. And that's why you need the funding, to make sure that you actually protect your democracy. It's that important.
Green Party leader Eamon Ryan, thank you very much for talking to us today. We're back with more after this break.